This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, episode number 16, was recorded on September 18th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Talk about a week in energy markets. Saudi Arabia's Abqaiq processing facility has long been understood by energy security experts to be a major vulnerability in the global energy market, and it was attacked this past weekend with devastating results. The resulting price shock was the biggest in oil market history, with Brent crude oil futures rocketing up 20% on Sunday evening's gap up open. Most of today's episode will focus on what happened, what comes next, and what investors should be paying attention to. I'll be joined this week by author and consultant Anas Alhaji and HedgeEye Energy Markets Chief Joe McMonagle. Pat Hemsworth was scheduled to join us today, but unfortunately she was unable to do so due to travel obligations. But before I introduce today's panel, let's start with this week's EIA energy data. Crude oil building 1.1 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma, though, still drawing down 647,000 barrels as those new pipelines continue to challenge Cushing's spare storage capacity and pipelining more of that oil away from Cushing down to the Gulf Coast where it's being exported. Gasoline building 781,000 barrels this week, distillates building 437,000 barrels. The tape action and reaction to inventory was to accelerate a downward move. We were already seeing oil prices retrace to the downside after the panic bid up on Sunday evening and into Monday and Tuesday, and that move to the downside accelerated with the reassurance of that crude oil build. U.S. production stood unchanged at 12.4 million barrels, imports 7 million barrels, exports 3.2 million barrels. Now let's meet our expert panel. Boots on the ground in Saudi Arabia, we have Dr. Anas Alhaji, an author, keynote speaker, and energy markets expert. He was formerly the chief economist for NGP Energy Capital Management and also taught energy economics at the University of Oklahoma and Colorado School of Mines. Anas, please explain the purpose and importance of the facilities at Abqaiq and Kurais, Saudi Arabia. Why are these two facilities so important to Saudi Arabia's ability to export crude oil? And what are the consequences and ramifications of the Abqaiq facility being taken partially offline?
Well, Abqaiq basically is located, just like Kurais and others, located in the eastern province where the major oil fields are, just like Warfield. It is, of course, owned by Aramco, and it was initially built by the American companies that owned Aramco at that time, which is in the 40s. So the facility is very old, and it played historical significance for a long time. It is the largest oil processing and stabilization plant in the region. It has a capacity of 7 million barrels a day. So the significance comes from the size, 7 million. However, before the attack, I think it was operating at 4.9, and they have that redundancy or the spare capacity, if you want to call it. The other significance is Abqaiq is situated on Abqaiq Field. So there is a field beneath it called Abqaiq Field, and it produces Arab Light. And they connected that to Shaiba Field. Shaiba is in the empty quarter, like hundreds of miles away, which produces super light. So the significance of this is it is kind of a cash cow for the Saudi government or for Aramco, since it is light and super light, which fetched higher prices in Asia for them. Let me mention here that Saudi Arabia exports the heavier, more sour crude to the U.S. because U.S. refineries need it. But the reason why Asia was affected by this, because all that light crude goes to Asia. Of course, the facility has a large number of cephroids. These are the tanks that looks like a dome. and it has 18 stabilizer columns. And the idea, this is kind of more of a processing plant. People kept saying refinery. It is not refinery. There is no refinery there. That's one of the mistakes in the media. So what they do is they get those various types of crude to GAIG. They process them. They need to clean that crude to make it basically available for shipping and for refineries. Some of those were hit in the attacks. Historically, experts and policymakers have been worried about this facility. The larger it got, the more worried they got. It has been one of the largest in the world for decades. There are many books and reports and articles talking about the security of GAIG. So this is not, talking about the security of GAIG is not new. People have been talking about it 30, 40, 50 years ago. And as I mentioned, there are books basically outlining exactly what everyone should read right now about what if this happened and what if this happened. It is heavily fortified, but unfortunately in the conventional way. There was an attack in 2006, a terrorist attack on it. They couldn't even enter the facility, and the cars exploded at the gate. So it is heavily fortified. Here is the problem, and here is the main lesson, and I will end with this idea here. Here is the lesson from what happened in Saudi Arabia on Saturday. Energy infrastructure security has not kept up with advancement in geomatic engineering, satellite cameras, apps on smartphones, wireless technologies, and drones. The events in Saudi Arabia might have awakened the industry, whether in the United States or everywhere else, to improve the security on this front. And I will end with that.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Anas. So just to summarize, if I think as a computer person, you know, all of the traffic on the internet, I've got my computer, you've got your computer, there's all these oil fields in Saudi Arabia, all the traffic has to go through a router in order to put it on the internet. And I think of GAIG is like the great big router in the sky. It's the processing facility through which all of these different oil fields, oil production has to be funneled. And therefore, as you said, it becomes a choke point. Incidentally, listeners, I did interview Dr. Pippa Malmgren, who's both a geopolitical consultant, a former presidential advisor, and presently a drone entrepreneur who knows all about drones, on this subject on Monday. So be sure to check your Macro Voices feed for that. I want to move on now to Joe McMonagle, who is former chief of staff of the U.S. Department of Energy and former vice chairman of the International Energy Agency. Joe regularly attends OPEC meetings and is a frequent commentator on oil markets for many major media outlets. Joe, obviously, with your background as chief of staff for the Department of Energy and your background with IEA, you have a very international perspective. So please tell us from that perspective, how significant is this GAIG facility from an international viewpoint? How critical is it to the overall global energy system? And particularly, what would the consequences be? This attack was not completely effective. Hypothetically, if there were more attacks and that facility were taken completely offline, what would the consequences of something like that be?
Well, Eric, it's great to be with you and Anas again. I think it's important for the listeners to realize that this facility is not just Saudi Arabia's biggest oil processing facility. It's the world's biggest oil processing facility. And so therefore, when it went offline after the attack and, you know, 5% of the world's supply went offline, you know, that's a major, as you said, it's a major choke point. As Anas said, the facility can't, you know, you can't just take the crude out of the ground and put it in pipelines or export it. It has to go through this facility in order to do any of that. So while it didn't hit production, it basically shut in production because the facility basically came offline. And so I'm still, despite the press conference yesterday, in which I think the Saudis put their best foot forward, tried to reassure markets, showed, I think, Aramco is in charge of getting this facility repaired and back up and running. And certainly there's probably no other company in the world more adept at being able to do that. I still am not sure that we know the full extent of the damage at the site. and the severity of the damage. And I'm still seeing conflicting reports about that. So I think the takeaways from the press conference yesterday with the prince in his essentially second week as the oil minister was that they have been able to get some of the operations of the site back up and running, but it's still not going to be at full capacity for some time. I know they have these targets. The end of the month, they want to have more of it up, and by the end of October, want to have it back to full capacity and Saudi production capacity back to its normal levels. But I don't think we know the answer to those questions until we actually see. Let's wait and see how they meet the October 1st goal that they've set for themselves. I think it's look, we already saw after the attack occurred and they said that it would be back up on Monday. You know, I think we already saw that some of those statements were overly optimistic. And so I am concerned about that. But I think moreover, I think for oil markets, it really indicates, number one, I think it reawakens geopolitical risk in oil markets. There's no way for markets to kind of yawn at events like this anymore. And in the past, markets would respond to tanker attacks and things like that. But for the most part, markets have been solely focused on the China trade war and the macroeconomic concerns, and basically have not really responded as they have traditionally done on geopolitical risk. And so I think this incident really, I think, brings geopolitical risk back to the fore. And I don't think we're past it. I think it's this, as Anas pointed out, I think correctly, I think this shows vulnerabilities, not just in Saudi Arabia and energy infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, but probably all over the world. And so I think the risk is great and rising. I think, you know, there are other shoes to drop about this incident that I think are going to continue to keep oil markets on its toes.
Joe, you raised a very important point, but here is the problem. The Saudis will never reveal the damage. I think they were very upset when the Trump administration basically released the pictures. They are not going to release it because they don't want the enemy basically to perfect their next attack. So there is no way they are going to release any information, and we will never know the extent of the damage. The other thing is there was a gag order, so no one was able even to speak, whether from Aramco or outside Aramco. Officials basically were not speaking. And I counted at least 15 accounts on Twitter that put pictures in the early morning hours immediately after the attack. They immediately, someone seemed like contacted them. They delete all the videos. They deleted all the pictures completely. So for about 2 hours until Al Arabiya TV basically showed some pictures, which is kind of, you can say, owned by the government or people who are part of the government. But no one in Saudi Arabia basically was able to talk or post pictures. So the problem here is only foreigners were able to talk, and that's why we got the chaos in terms of information, which is we know now that most of it was inaccurate. Some people thought that some contractors basically were giving them information. The contractors did not get in until later, so there were no contractors on the premises. So how they got the information? So I think the bottom line here is, yes, we need this information for the benefits of the market, but from a security point of view, the Saudis will never release it.
I totally agree with you, Anas, and that was one of the things that I tweeted immediately as we were anticipating the press conference, that we probably would not get full transparency because they didn't want to disclose information to their adversaries. And so I agree with you completely.
Let's talk next about precisely what happened here, who potentially did it, who the suspects are, and particularly, is it possible that they still have the wherewithal to do it again? Now, at first, it seemed like there was just a declaration that Iran did this, and then Houthi rebels in Yemen claimed victory, said, no, no, we did it, and we launched the strike from here, from Yemen, south of Saudi Arabia, so opposite direction than an inbound strike from Iran. And then at one point, the United States was absolutely positively certain, they said, that they had incontrovertible evidence that the attack was in fact launched from Iraq, but it was Iranian interests in Iraq that had launched it. And then they backtracked from that and said, okay, never mind, it might have been incontrovertible, but we were wrong. And it was actually launched from Iranian soil. So we don't have a straight answer on where this initiated, including one party claiming that they're responsible, that so far I think most experts have dismissed and said, wait a minute, Houthi rebels don't have the sophistication to pull something like this off. They may be claiming to be responsible, but they didn't really do it. And then we've got the further complication that there's been a report that this was a drone attack. Then there was another report saying, no, it was never a drone attack. It was actually a missile attack. And then I heard another report that said it was a combination of drones and missiles that were used in a concerted strike. Of course, if there were both of those together, it would tend to really bring into question whether the Houthis in Yemen could have pulled this off. So, Anas, you're there, boots on the ground in Saudi Arabia. What is the thinking there as far as who did it? And particularly, is whoever did it capable of perhaps doing it again and doing more damage than has already occurred?
Well, 2 points here. The Saudis did not point the fingers at all. They've been very careful until today after Pompeo basically visited Saudi Arabia today and they start talking about Iran. But we kept hearing from the Saudi side that it is the Houthis, and they kept emphasizing that it came from the Houthis in Yemen. And they started talking about kind of Iran-sponsored group. We don't know. And then we have, supposedly we heard the news that there was an attack on targets, Iranian targets in Syria, which Saudi Arabia participated in just kind of like a few hours ago. So we don't know, because why they are attacking targets in Syria, were the whatever being launched from there, or we don't know. So for me, the two questions that you ask, basically, everything is open at this stage. What being used and who did it is still open. But at least we can make the following assumptions. The attacks were so sophisticated and require deep technical knowledge of oil processing. Only state-supported actors can carry such an operation. The Cephroid walls, for example, are thick and they require kind of special weapons. And making such hold basically with such precision raises eyebrows. The other issue that is related to this is, and I heard it from a couple of people, said, whoever did this, it seems they either commissioned research on the security of GIG, or they benefited from research that's already out there. And this is kind of, when we talk about energy security, probably we get to watch, it's not only about keeping up with all this new technology, we got to be careful too with such research now, whether it's going to be used by attackers.
Anas, what is the mood there in Saudi Arabia with respect to fear that there could be a second strike coming? Is that something that's on the radar at this point?
I think it is a concern, but in terms of the mood, we can see it when the prince and the CEO of Aramco and the chairman of the board walked into the conference, and the prince basically started with a statement along the line of, I would like to convey to you the king and the crown prince kind of message to you that we were able to restore supplies to the world, and everyone in the room basically was cheering and clapping. So the mood basically on the recovery, people were bragging about how Aramco was able to do it. I mean, this is more kind of a joyous mood on the recovery than what everyone could expect.
Joe McMonagle, let's talk, first of all, any reactions that you might have to what Anna said, but also from your experience, having run the U.S. Department of Energy and being vice chairman of IEA, as you said earlier, this changes everything. Suddenly, energy security has to come into focus as being much more than what people thought it was. And I guess the real question on my mind, regardless of whether or not there's anyone who's about to do it, what would it mean to the world if somebody figured out a way to completely annihilate a facility like Abgag and shut it down so it was, you know, beyond any possible repair, so it would take years to bring it back online? Obviously, that's not the situation here by any stretch, But what worries me is, what if the next attack was more sophisticated? What if they really got the big guns out for the next one, or somebody else with more firepower were to try to do this on some other key choke point facility around the world? To what extent is the world economy at risk of a major dislocation as a result of an energy terrorism event?
Again, I concur with Anas on his observations. I do think, you know, the energy minister and the Aramco leadership wanted to put a good foot forward and exude confidence about the ability to repair the facility and get it back up and running. I think they accomplished that. I think it's just a matter of timing and how long it will take to do that. I think that's still a question mark in my mind. I have confidence they can do it. It's just a matter of time. This facility, though, as Anas pointed out, it's been well known that it's a key facility. I mean, when I was in the U.S. government in early, after 9/11, we know from intelligence that this was on Al-Qaeda's list of top targets. It's, as Anas pointed out, there was a terrorist attack, you know, that was repelled at the site. It has been believed to have been the most secure and well-guarded site in the world. I mean, there are Patriot missile batteries there. There are other types of anti-missile and aircraft weaponry there. But as Anas points out, there's been technology advancements that have found a vulnerability here. And maybe it wasn't all about technology. Maybe it was just, you know, the folks not being as vigilant as they probably should be at a site like this. I do worry that this could be replicated. I mean, look, if tomorrow there is another attack on this facility while it's being repaired, just the fact that they're able to, even if there's not a lot more damage done, you would see big spikes in oil prices in addition to what we saw after Saturday's attack. And this is not just a Saudi problem. This is a energy infrastructure wake-up call and other types of key infrastructure, not just energy related. But obviously, this is a big geopolitical issue with Iran. You know, as I've pointed out in the past, I mean, Iran is pursuing a maximum chaos policy in response to the U.S. Maximum pressure policy. They started with these tanker attacks. They started with drone attacks on pipelines in Saudi Arabia. And now they've done this. Some people may say, you know, a lot of people said, oh, these attacks have been calibrated. Well, this one is not calibrated. This is, as Secretary Pompeo said on his arrival in Riyadh, it was an act of war. And in terms of who's responsible for it, I mean, there's no question, nobody believes the Houthi rebels were behind this. Washington, I think, strongly believes it was Iran. I think they're going to disclose proof of that in the coming days. I think you can expect to see a lot more PR about this at the UN next week. And, you know, the only question is, where did it come from? Did it come from Iraqi soil, as I think was some initial thoughts, you know, that Iranian militants or even Iranian Revolutionary Guards did this from Iraq soil. But now, I mean, the talk in Washington all week has been that it originated from Iran's boundaries itself. So that's a game changer, I think, here. And it's hard to let it go unanswered. We're hearing of potentially some Saudi aircraft involved in strikes against Iranian militia sites in Syria. Maybe that is the response. I happen to think that the response will have to be calibrated as well, and that it will probably target Iranian energy infrastructure. And that's what the administration is discussing right now. What is the calibrated response? I don't think there's a question of whether there will be a response. I think it's a question of what it will be and, you know, what form it will take place. But I just don't see this going unanswered by either Saudi Arabia or by the U.S.
What would the consequences be, Joe, and the implications if more successful attack were to take a facility like Abqaiq completely and totally offline, destroy it completely so it had to be rebuilt? What would that mean? How long would it last? And for what period of time would it disrupt global energy markets before some workaround could be designed?
Well, there are, I mean, the Saudis have, you know, crude reserves that could come into play. And I suspect that they are tapping that now to try to return, you know, to keep export levels current. You know, I think there's, I think the last Jody data was about 180 million barrels of reserves. There are, you know, of course, the IEA and the U.S. SPRO would probably be deployed in such an incident. In this incident, the you know, the president announced, you know, that he had authorized the SPRO release, but left the sort of the timing and the amounts up to DOE. The IEA has taken, I think, a more cautious approach and has said that, you know, they believe, you know, that the world is well supplied and that there's no need for any kind of coordinated response by consuming countries that have reserves. But I suspect that the U.S. government is probably pushing IEA to seriously consider getting ready to do something. And certainly, if there were to be the type of attack you described, I think you would see immediately from the IEA and the U.S. an announcement about releasing crude stocks to address supply concerns. So, I mean, I think this is a very this vulnerability issue is very real. The Kuwait military is now on high alert as a result of the attacks that was announced today. And, you know, this incident is not over just because the attack ended on Saturday. There's still many steps to play out here. And so I think geopolitical risk is not only back, it's going to be rising, I think, in the days and weeks ahead.
Before we move on to market implications of this, Anas, any reactions to what Joe's just told us?
Yes, a couple of things. First of all, it is very clear that, at least to me, that when President Trump authorized the use of the Strategic Petroleum Reserves, and he announced it on Twitter 4 minutes before the Asian markets opened on Monday, kind of to influence the market. And then the Saudis basically leaked the information to the media just minutes basically after the market opened in the United States on Tuesday. That gives you the impression that those are coordinated. So historically, the SPR release was always coordinated with Saudi Arabia. So this could be coordinated between the Trump administration and the Saudis. He will do one on Monday and they will do one on Tuesday. And therefore, there was no need for the IEA in this case to do something because they were kind of emphasizing the point that everything is under control. The second point is I have kind of a special theory on this and the role of spare capacity. As we know, it is the strategic objective of Saudi Arabia to be a reliable and dependable supplier of oil to the world. It is the strategic objective of Saudi Arabia to be a swing producer to eliminate extreme volatility. I know you want to talk about the impact of the market, so I'm getting into that. So their objective from using the spare capacity, basically, is to eliminate extreme volatility in the oil market. To achieve those strategic objectives, they need to keep large spare capacity. Therefore, keeping spare capacity becomes a strategic objective. Now, if the enemy knows that and it is a strategic objective, then the enemy is going to hit it. So on the other side, spare capacity gives Riyadh its global, political, strategic, and economic clout. In a sense, spare capacity is power. Now, Russia produces more than Saudi Arabia, but it does not have the same power like Saudi Arabia. The United States produces more than Saudi Arabia, but it does not have the same power of Saudi Arabia in the oil market because spare capacity is power. So the attack on GIG was not aimed at damaging some oil infrastructure only, but also at stripping Saudi Arabia of that power. This explains the reaction of other countries. This explains why Saudi Arabia did whatever it did, whatever it takes, basically, to restore production and bring normalcy to the oil market. So the idea here is the target was really, the end target was the spare capacity and the power generated from it.
Anna, since you brought up the topic of markets, let's move on to that next. This was the biggest price dislocation in the history of the crude oil market, bigger than Gulf War I, with Brent crude futures gapping on the open and spiking up to 20% above where they closed on Friday. Now, as we're speaking Wednesday afternoon, we've retraced little more than half of the way from the absolute highs back to where we were on Friday. WTI, as I'm looking at it now, is sitting right on its five-day moving average at 58.05. That often, when we see a move like this, you go way above the averages. Oftentimes, you come back and retest the five before springboarding higher. So are we looking at a situation where this thing is ending and we're about to retrace fully, close that gap, and maybe move lower in prices? Or is this more of a situation where we're in the calm before the storm, where the market is unreacting from Saturday's events, but has yet to even gear up to react to what could be a military response from the U.S. against Iran or whatever comes next? So are we at the beginning of the de-escalation, or are we getting ready for a re-escalation? Anas, what's your take on what might be in store for the market?
Well, generally speaking, I think the Saudis, whether people believe them or not, it doesn't matter. The job already been done. I think there was confusion in the market because of two reasons, despite the press conference. I think there was a confusion, and people are still questioning this. They are missing the point. The confusion basically is restoring production or restoring supply is not about the ability of Aramco to repair the damage, because people are saying, well, take 6 months or take a year to repair this. And no, this is irrelevant at this stage. It is about the ability of Saudi Arabia or Aramco to work around the damage. And working around the damage or around the repairs basically brings this additional crude or restore some of the crude, whether supplies or production. The other confusion basically is the difference between production and supplies. The Saudis emphasized the point supplies several times in the press conference. And as you know, historically, in the last few years, we heard it a lot from the previous minister Al-Faleh when he said supplies, not production. So these two points are extremely important to understand how the Saudis basically were able to do this. So supplies are not production, and repairs are different from working around the repairs. Once we put this aside, now we understand what's going on. The issue here is they can do a lot of retooling because there is a lot of redundancy at those facilities. And one thing that the analyst missed, while everyone was focusing on GIG, Aramco immediately on Saturday started working on Khurais. No one mentioned Khurais. Most of that increase in production and restoration happened at Khurais, and Khurais is not connected to GIG. So what they did is they have, like Joe earlier mentioned, we have Saudi storage inside and outside the country. When he mentioned that 180 million, that's inside and outside the country. But what they mentioned in the press conference, something no one in the media mentioned, when they mentioned that we do have our own strategic reserves and it's secret and no one knows its size, and we are already using it. So they are using all those basically to increase supplies. The other thing is they are diverting crude and NGLs from domestic refineries and petrochemical plants to exports. We already have seen reduction of supplies to petrochemical plants. Now the situation improved. I think that reduction reached like 49%, and now probably it's in 25 to 30%. Now they are getting some feedstock that they were not able to get there. So we have the partial recovery, we have the diversion of crude, and we have the commercial inventories, we have the strategic inventories. We have all of those that enabled them basically to recover most of the production and be able to supply, and again, back to the word supply here, and export the quantities for September that they already agreed on. And as a result of that, we've seen, as you mentioned, prices basically going up. And then with all this news, basically prices has to go down. Now, we still have a lot of people who are doubting, who doubted what the Saudis are saying. And at this stage, really, it doesn't matter because the Saudis will never release that information about the damage, as we mentioned in the past. No one in the world knows what that damage is. So people can keep talking about it, but they have no evidence. And as Joe mentioned earlier, we have the test coming in October. So we'll figure out how credible they were in their statements. My guess is we don't have to judge it like on the 30th of October that whether they have that production or not. We have to give them some leeway, some days. As long as they are close to that target, they are fine. But even if they are not correct in this estimate, and even if they are late a month or two, it doesn't matter anymore. They already returned to normal.
I want to interrupt you, Anas, because you're making a very important point, which is you're saying the whole world is focused on the wrong question. They're asking, how long is it going to take to fix the things that got broken? That's not the right question to ask. The right question to ask is, how much has Saudi Arabia's ability to deliver oil actually been impacted after you consider their strategic reserves and other things that are available to them to work around those repairs? So since you've so eloquently highlighted that question, let me pose that question to you. How much of a big deal is this in terms of, you know, how much impact is there really on Saudi Arabia's ability to continue delivering oil at the pace that it historically has been? Net of all of the remedies that are available to them, how big of a deal is this and how long will it last?
I think what they mentioned basically at the press conference is they can go back to 9.8, which is the pre-attack production level, by the end of October, and they can recover the whole 12 million barrel capacity by the end of November. However, the issue here is, and this is kind of the important point, is how much of spare capacity they can bring online as fast as they can relative to pre-attack. And I think this is really the hard question that no one will know, but I think that should be asked, because that's really where the impact is. And I think Joe agrees with me on this point.
Joe McMonagle, Anas says Saudi Arabia can get back in very short order to 9.8 million barrels of production. As an outsider, do you believe that story? Or is that perhaps a little bit of trying to reassure markets when maybe there's more risk than meets the eye?
Well, I think they reassured markets, I think, with the press conference on Monday, or on Tuesday, I guess it was. And so I think markets are relatively calm now, but I still think there's an elevated risk, both in terms of, you know, as we said before, geopolitical risk and the vulnerability of these key sites, also regarding potential responses to the attack and where that may lead. But I think to underscore what Anas said, I think the market is really focused on the spare capacity question. And so, you know, even though they can maintain the 9.8 level, which is, you know, a much lower level than they would normally be at, you know, because they've been, you know, participating in these production cuts with OPEC and sort of leading the way there. What this does do is it takes away the Saudis' ability to have this spare capacity, which has been a calming influence and confidence building measure for markets and a source of their clout, as Anas pointed out in one of his earlier answers. And so that, I think, is, you know, now we're in a little bit of a phase here, even for a month or 2 months, where the spare capacity, instead of being, you know, 2 million barrels a day, is 500,000 barrels a day. And you add maybe Iraq can add, you know, a couple hundred thousand barrels, or UAE can add a little bit. But, you know, we're significantly below what the world generally thinks spare capacity is to deal with some kind of disruption. That's, I think, why prices are a little bit elevated here. And until that can come back, whenever that is, I think we are going to have some tightness in markets.
Anas, any reactions?
Yes. Basically, I would like to mention the following example, and then I'll move on to what Joe said about spare capacity. In the United States, one of the issues we have with the natural gas market that started basically with the shale revolution and the lower prices of gas that we've seen switching from coal to natural gas. And one of the problems we encountered in this atmosphere is, as gas prices went up, we've seen power plants basically dumping natural gas on the market in matter of hours and suppressing prices. That's why we never seen a kind of a major recovery in oil prices for a long time, because that fear of the power plants basically just dumping 4, 5, 6 BCF a day on the market. Now, take this example and think of the role of China in the last 10 years in the oil market. China been stocking oil, whether strategic or commercial, for a very long time. So China now is playing that role of the power plants with the gas market in the United States. So aside from the spare capacity, we have to be mindful of the fact that China can destock with higher prices in matter of hours and days and affect prices. And the destocking of China could be way larger. The amount of destocking could be way larger than any spare capacity in OPEC. And they can influence prices. So in a sense, China is now the true valve in the oil market. And that's why we are not going to hit 100, even if we get major damage in such facilities.
Let's move on now and talk about what could come next in this conflict. Let's assume for the sake of argument that the attacks are over, that Saudi Arabia is not going to be hit with any more drones or missiles. But it is very likely that the U.S. will engage in, at minimum, some harsher sanctions and maybe military engagement with Iran. And it seems to me that this is a very complicated puzzle because on one hand, no matter how much it escalates, if it's just Iran, in other words, if it's the U.S. does cruise missile strikes or whatever they do, and it's just U.S. versus Iran, okay, Iranian production maybe comes offline. It was mostly off the market except for the black market because of sanctions anyway. It's not that big of a deal. But if China and Russia, either one of them or both of them, were to come to Iran's aid and suddenly this escalates to U.S. versus Russia and China, that could be a geopolitical crisis of monumental proportion. Is that a risk? Is it headed in that direction? Or are we just going to see some sanctions on Iran and this is going to be over? Joe, what's your take?
Well, the president's already announced new sanctions today, although it's unclear exactly what they are going to be. I mean, Iran is essentially being sanctioned to the maximum. So I'm not sure there's much more to do in terms of sanctions. I guess, you know, if this does prove out and the U.S. can really confidently prove that Iran did this, I think there is a question of what happens in terms of European sanctions. The EU has been trying to keep the Iranians in the JCPOA commitments, and so they have not joined the U.S. in reimposing sanctions as a result of that. But, you know, there are big questions if they start violating the JCPOA in more meaningful ways. And obviously, if they do other things that have nothing to do with the JCPOA, like attacking their neighbors with military strikes, I mean, that's something that Europe has to think about. So maybe there's some more sanctions from the EU that have to be considered. My guess is the EU is going to be very cautious about moving in that direction. But I think it's going to be hard to ignore, you know, if Iran's fingerprints are all over this and it can be proven without question. And I think you're going to see a lot of this at the UN next week. So it's going to really, I think, paint Iran's misbehavior and highlight it next week at the UN. And the Iranians are, of course, now talking about not coming. So I think that just will draw more attention to the whole issue. So that's sort of what I see. I do think that we will see some kind of response, but I think it's going to be calibrated. I think it's going to be focused on energy infrastructure. I really do. I think there's some vulnerable natural gas assets that could potentially, you know, see some action, whether it's airstrikes or it's something that just happens and there's no actual fingerprints on who did it. I do think you're going to see something like that. I don't know what happens after that. I mean, the Iranians, they're trying to basically get the U.S. to relieve sanctions on them and energy sanctions. I think they're going about it the wrong way. But I'm amused to keep seeing people, you know, different commentators talk about, you know, that this is the U.S. The U.S. is at fault here for for reimposing sanctions. Of course, the Iranians have to do these things and sort of sanctioning, if you will, the Iranian misbehavior. And I just don't think you can do that. It'll just become bolder and bolder. But I'm sure people are thinking you take some kind of calibrated response. What is the Iranian response? The Iranians, of course, are threatening a lot of retaliation if they are attacked. I think threatening other neighbors, which is why you saw the Kuwaitis go on high alert today. So these are all the discussions that are going on right now. I do think, Trump certainly doesn't want to get into another war. I think he's made that very, very clear. However, there are other U.S. national security concerns at stake here. And I think also from a political standpoint, I think we're entering a phase where, you want to show strong presidential leadership on something like this. So I do think it'll be calibrated, but I think it's a mistake for people to extrapolate what happened when the Iranians shot down that drone and Trump sort of had a very sort of cautious approach, called back the airstrike, and instead there was some cyber attacks and of course we shot down an Iranian drone. And I think people took away from that, Trump, will do everything to avoid something here. If they push him, he's going to respond. And I think it's a mistake to extrapolate that one incident to what Trump will or will not do, or the U.S. will or will not do in this situation. And the other thing I pointed out in my notes in Hedgeye this week and in conversations with clients is I think the oil market now has to contemplate something it hadn't yet envisioned. And that is, what is a Saudi response to this attack? I think, typically the Saudis, or traditionally the Saudis, have been very cautious about this type of thing. But, we have a new king, King Salman, the crown prince. They have a different style, I think, that's been demonstrated. And this is something they haven't faced yet either. And so I don't think we could just say the Saudis are just going to let the U.S. do it here. I think there could be a response here. The question is, how many times are they going to be attacked, but their oil infrastructure is going to be attacked without some kind of response? And I don't think that's something that oil markets had considered up to this point.
Anas, you obviously understand the role of Prince Abdul Aziz bin Salman and King Salman. What do you make of what Joe just said? What do you think that these leaders might do differently than their predecessors in terms of the Saudi response?
Couple of points here. The first one is, Joe mentioned they are cautious, and they are cautious for a reason. If you listen to the Saudi experts and what they are saying, look, we do not want a limited attack. We do not want a targeted attack. And the reason why Saudi Arabia, even the UAE, is not responding, because they are afraid that once they start the attack, then Trump will get cold feet and leave them up there in the cold. So it is really, Trump is the problem here. It's not anything else. They are seriously afraid of Trump walking with them to the middle of the road and then leaving them to the Iranians. And that's a big, big issue. So they are cautious for a reason, because it is President Trump who cannot be trusted on walking the whole way. The other point related to this is that once we look at the history of Saudi Arabia, remember that they faced a major disaster when Saddam Hussein rolled into Kuwait and then to the Saudi city of Khafji. And then they were able, with the help of the United States at that time, when George Bush Sr. was president, they were able to build that coalition. It took them a year, but they were able to liberate the whole area. So they did face major crises in the past, but they needed that international coalition. King Salman already said it yesterday. The Council of Ministers mentioned it, that they need an international coalition. The foreign ministry said it. And then yesterday in the conference, in the news conference, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, since you asked that question, he said, look, and I think Joe mentioned this earlier at the beginning of the show, that this is an international problem. Loss of supply of 5.7 million barrels a day is a global problem, is an international problem. every economy is going to be affected. And his point of view was, since every economy is going to be affected, then they have to build a coalition to stop those attacks. So the issue here is they don't want limited attack. They don't want targeted attack. They wanted Trump to stand with them the same way George Bush Sr. did. And will he? Well, we have doubts about that.
Finally, gentlemen, I want to, as always, end our show today by asking each of you, as this situation unfolds in coming days and weeks, what are the key signposts that you're going to be watching for? What are you waiting to see which way it goes? What are the signals that investors should be paying attention to as this situation continues to develop? Anas, let's start with you.
Definitely, we are going to watch the Saudi oil exports on a daily basis. We are going to see their domestic market and how much oil and products and feedstock they are going to return to the market within Saudi Arabia. We are going to watch the global stocks, of course. We are going to watch the U.S. stocks. However, one final point here is just kind of to conclude everything we talked about. These attacks on Gaig and Khurais in Saudi Arabia will go into history books in several fields, whether talking about engineering and the ability to do marvelous things, whether talking about the management and how this managed, whether economics, finance, communications, what the failures, what are the good things they did, how the media covered it, military and defense and politics. I think there is massive amount to cover for researchers for years to come.
Joe McMonagle, what are you going to be watching for as this situation continues to develop?
Well, I this is an unusual podcast because Anas and I are agreeing on more and more things. So I agree with everything he said today. And I would just add, you know, yes, I think the market's going to be watching on the supplies coming back online and updates on the repairs. But I still think we're kind of like at the beginning of this whole situation. And I see, you know, as I've said a couple times here, I do think there's going to be a response. I think in the next couple days, actually, we hear, you know, more from the U.S. in terms of who's responsible, how it happened, and additional steps that might be taken. And again, I'm waiting for some kind of military response. I think we're going to see something take shape soon. And you know, we don't know how Iran will react to that. I mean, they're making a lot of noise that it will be escalated. You know, a lot of people are blaming the U.S. sanctions for this, but Iran is the one that's really escalated this with this attack.
Well, and the United States was actually talking about easing sanctions just before this happened. So I guess Iran has probably closed the door to that possibility. Finally, before we close, I want to ask each of you just to tell our listeners who are interested in following more of your work, what's your Twitter handle? How can people learn more about what you do? Anas?
My website is my name, Anas Alhaji, AnasAlhaji.com. There are a lot of articles and other things there. And then I put a lot of things on Twitter, including breaking news and other stuff. It is at Anas Alhaji, which is at my name, my first name, my last name.
And Joe McMonagle, you head up the Energy Department for Hedgeye Research. Tell us a little bit about what you do there and how people can learn more about your products and services.
That's right. I cover energy markets, energy geopolitics, OPEC, and energy policy for Hedgeye. We publish a lot of excerpts on the Hedgeye's website, public website for free. That's hedgeye.com. But we do a lot more than that. We have conference calls with expert analysis and a lot of client engagement. So if people are interested in that, they could shoot an email to sales@hedgeye.com. But like Anas, I do a lot of updates on Twitter, and people can watch me there at Joe McMonagle, JoeMcMonigle.
And we'll be back next week with another installment of Energy Week. Art Berman, if you're listening, sir, you picked a hell of a week to take a vacation from the energy market. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.